This is the next chapter in J.H. Milner Bean's History of the Reformation in England. And this chapter is entitled Wolsey's Hopes and Fears, 1523-25, Cardinal Wolsey. Pope Adrian VI died on the 14th of September 1523, before the end of the second year of his pontificate. Wolsey thought himself pope. At length he would no longer be the favourite only, but the arbiter of the kings of the earth. And his genius, for which England was too narrow, would have Europe and the world for its stage. Already revolving gigantic projects in his mind, the future pope dreamt of the destruction of heresy in the West, and in the East the cessation of the Greek schism, and new crusades to replant the cross on the walls of Constantinople. There is nothing that Wolsey would not have dared undertake when once seated on the throne of Catholicism, and the pontificates of Gregory VII and Innocent III would have been eclipsed by that of Ipswich's butcher son. Cardinal reminded Henry of his promise, and the very next day the king signed a letter addressed to the Emperor Charles V, the nephew of Catherine, Queen of England. Believing himself sure of the Emperor, Wolsey turned all his exertions to the side of Rome. "The legate of England," said Henry's ambassadors to the cardinals, "is the very man for the present time. He is the only one thoroughly acquainted with the interests and wants of Christendom, and strong enough to provide for them. He is all kindness, and will share his dignities and wealth among all the prelates who support him." But Giulio de' Medici, the titular bishop of Worcester, himself aspired to the papacy, and as 18 cardinals were devoted to him, the election could not take place without his support. "Rather than yield," said he in the conclave, "I would die in this prison." A month passed away, and nothing was done. New intrigues were then resorted to. There were cabals for Wolsey, cabals for Medici. The cardinals were besieged. Into their midst, by many a secret path, creeps sly intrigue. At length, on the 18th of November, 1523, the people collected under their windows, shouting, "No foreign pope!" After 49 days of debating, Giulio was elected and, according to his own expression, bent his head beneath the yoke of apostolic servitude. He took the name of Clement VII. Wolsey was exasperated. It was in vain that he presented himself before St. Peter's chair at each vacancy. A more active or more fortunate rival always reached it before him. Master of England and the most influential of European diplomatists, he saw men preferred to him who were his inferiors. This election was an event which favoured the Reformation in England. Wolsey, as Pope, would, humanely speaking, have tightened the cords which already bound England so closely to Rome. But Wolsey, rejected, could hardly fail to throw himself into tortuous paths which would perhaps contribute to the emancipation of the Church. He became more crafty than ever, declared to Henry that the new election was quite in conformity with his wishes, and hastened to congratulate the new Pope. He wrote to Dr. Pace at Rome, "This election, I assure you, is as much to the king's and my rejoicing, consolation and gladness as possibly may be devised or imagined. Ye shall show unto his holiness what joy, comfort and gladness it is, both to the king's highness and me, to perceive that once in our lives it hath pleased God of his great goodness to provide such a pastor unto his church, as his grace and I have long inwardly desired. Who for his virtue, wisdom, and other high and notable qualities, we have always reputed the most able and worthy person to be called to that dignity." But the Pope, divining his competitor's vexation, sent the king a golden rose and a ring to Wolsey. "I'm sorry," he said, as he drew it from his finger, "that I cannot present it to his eminence in person." Clement, moreover, conferred on him the quality of legate for life, an office which had hitherto been temporary only. Thus the Popedom and England embraced each other, and nothing appeared more distant than that Christian revolution which was destined very shortly to emancipate Britain from the tutelage of the Vatican. Wolsey's disappointed ambition made him suspend the proceedings of the clergy at Cambridge. He had revenge in his heart and cared not to persecute his fellow countrymen merely to please his rival. And besides, like several popes, he had a certain fondness for learning. To send a few Lollards to prison was a matter of no difficulty, but learned doctors, this required a closer examination. Hence he gave Rome a sign of independence, and yet it was not specially against the Pope that he began to entertain sinister designs. Clement had been more fortunate than himself, but that was no reason why he should be angry with him. Charles V was the offender, and Wolsey swore a deadly hatred against him. Resolved to strike, he sought only the place where he could inflict the severest blow. To obtain his end, he resolved to dissemble his passion and to distil drop by drop into Henry's mind that mortal hatred against Charles, which gave fresh energy to his activity. Charles discovered the indignation that lay hid under Wolsey's apparent mildness and, wishing to retain Henry's alliance, he made more pressing advances to the king. Having deprived the minister of a tiara, he resolved to offer the king a crown. This was indeed a noble compensation. "You are king of France," the emperor said, "and I undertake to win your kingdom for you. Only send an ambassador to Italy to negotiate the matter." Wolsey, who could hardly contain his vexation, was forced to comply, in appearance at least, with the emperor's views. The king, indeed, seemed to think of nothing but his arrival at St. Germain's and commissioned Pace to visit Italy for this important business. Wolsey hoped that he would be unable to execute his commission. It was impossible to cross the Alps, for the French troops blockaded every passage. But Pace, who was one of those adventurous characters whom nothing can stop, spurred on by the thought that the king himself had sent him, determined to cross the Col di Tenda. On the 27th of July, 1524, he entered the mountains, traversed precipitous passes, sometimes climbing them on all fours, and often falling during the descent. In some places he could ride on horseback, but in the most part thereof I durst not either turn my horse, traverse, he wrote to the king, for all the worldly riches, nor in manner look on my left hand for the steep slope and steepness to the valley. After this passage, which lasted 6 days, Pace arrived in Italy, worn out by fatigue. "If the King of England will enter France immediately by way of Normandy," said the Constable of Bourbon to him, "I will give him leave to pluck out both my eyes if he is not master of Paris before All Saints. And when Paris is taken, he will be master of the whole kingdom." But Wolsey, to whom these remarks were transmitted by the ambassador, slighted them, delayed furnishing the subsidies, and required certain conditions which were calculated to thwart the project. Pace, who was ardent and ever imprudent, but plain and straightforward, forgot himself, and in a moment of vexation wrote to Wolsey, "To speak frankly, if you do not attend to these things, I shall impute to your grace the loss of the crown of France." These words ruined Henry's envoy in the cardinal's mind. Was this man who owed everything to him trying to supplant him? Pace in vain assured Wolsey that he should not take seriously what he had said, but the bolt had hit. Pace was associated with Charles in the cruel enmity of the minister, and he was one day to feel its terrible effects. It was not long before Wolsey was able to satisfy himself that the service Charles had desired to render the King of England was beyond the Emperor's strength. No sooner at ease on one side than Wolsey found himself attacked on the other. This man, the most powerful among king's favourites, felt at this time the first breath of disfavour blow over him. On the pontifical throne he would no doubt have attempted a reform after the manner of Sixtus V, and wishing to rehearse on a smaller stage and regenerate after his own fashion the Catholic Church in England, he submitted the monasteries to a strict inquisition, patronised the instruction of youth, and was the first to set a great example by suppressing certain religious houses whose revenues he applied to his college in Oxford. Thomas Cromwell, his right-hand man, displayed much skill and industry in this business, and thus, under the orders of a cardinal of the Roman Church, made his first campaign in a war of which he was in later days to hold the chief command. Wolsey and Cromwell, by their reforms, drew down the hatred of certain monks, priests, and noblemen, always the very humble servants of the clerical party. The latter accused the cardinal of not having estimated the monasteries at their just value, and of having in certain cases encroached on the royal jurisdiction. Henry, whom the loss of the crown of France had put in a bad humour, resolved for the first time not to spare his minister. "There are loud murmurs throughout this kingdom," he said to him. "It is asserted that your new college at Oxford is only a convenient cloak to hide your malversations. "God forbid," replied the cardinal, "that this virtuous foundation at Oxford, undertake for the good of my poor soul, should be raised ex rapinis, out of plunderings. But above all, God forbid that I should ever encroach upon your royal authority." He then cunningly insinuated that by his will he left all his property to the king. Henry was satisfied. He had a share in the business. Events of very different importance drew the king's attention to another quarter. The two armies of the Empire and of France were met for battle before Pavia in the plain of Lombardy. Wolsey, who openly gave his right hand to Charles V, and secretly his left to Francis, repeated to his master, "If the Emperor gains the victory, are you not his ally, and if Francis, am I not in secret communication with him?" "Thus," added the cardinal, "whatever happens, your highness will have great cause to give thanks to Almighty God." On the 24th of February 1525, the Battle of Pavia was fought. The army of Francis I was utterly routed. The king himself was taken prisoner to Madrid. "Of all things," he wrote to his mother, "nothing remains to me but honour and life." Charles V, who celebrated his 25th birthday on the day of the battle, was virtually Emperor of the West. England apart, he was supreme over all. Henry and Wolsey had in every sense been playing a double game. Professing friendship for Charles and bound to support his cause by the Treaty of Windsor of August 1522, they had at the same time been negotiating with Charles' enemy, Francis I of France. The agent employed in the negotiations was Giovanni Giovacchino di Pisano, known as the English court as John Joachim, who passed for a merchant of Bologna and lived in concealment at Blackfriars. In fact, he was a Genoese attached to the household of Louise, mother of the French king, and, after Pavia, regent of France until the release of her son from custody at Madrid. Dupré, the imperial ambassador in London, had secret knowledge of Joachim's presence in the city, and his master was not unaware that Henry and Wolsey were not to be trusted. He was indeed much too knowledgeable of the diplomatic situation to be deceived by them. When, after Pavia, Wolsey urged upon him a joint invasion of France as a reward for which Henry was to become its king, Charles bluntly refused to consider the proposal and for the rest of the year ignored English suggestions. Wisely so, for meanwhile Wolsey reopened negotiations with Louise, accepting her secret present for himself of 100,000 crowns, and concluded a treaty of peace between the two countries. In March 1526, Charles released his royal prisoner. After obtaining his assent to onerous treaty terms, at the same time requiring him to surrender to him his two sons as hostages for his future good faith. To Louise, Wolsey expressed the hope that Francis would feel free to repudiate his solemn promises at the first convenient opportunity. Feeling certain that Charles had obstructed his accession to the popedom, Wolsey hoped to prove to him by such actions that it was dangerous to thwart the ambitions of a cardinal and chancellor. While diplomatic moves of great intricacy and delicacy thus occupied Wolsey's attention, he met with difficulties in home affairs, particularly in matters of finance. Foreign policy, to be effective, must be backed by adequate expenditure on armed forces. In 1523, the Chancellor had himself visited the House of Commons to demand 4 shillings in the pound of every man's land and goods. The Commons administered to him a humiliating rebuff and voted a much smaller sum. In 1525, he demanded no less than 1/6 of the movables and incomes of the laity, and more still from the clergy. "You desire to conquer France," said Wolsey. "You are right. Give me, then, for that purpose, the 1/6 part of your property. That is a trifle to gratify so noble an inclination." England did not think so. This illegal demand aroused universal complaint. "We are English and not French, free men and not slaves," was the universal cry. Wolsey might tyrannize over the court, but not lay hands on the property of the king's subjects. The eastern counties rose in insurrection. 4,000 men were under arms in a moment, and Henry was guarded in his own palace by only a few servants. It was necessary to break down the bridges to stop the insurgents. The courtiers complained to the king. The king threw the blame on the cardinal. The cardinal laid it on the clergy, some of whom had encouraged him to impose this tax by quoting to him the example of Joseph demanding of the Egyptians the fifth part of their goods. And the clergy, in their turn, ascribed the insurrection to the gospelers, who, said they, were stirring up a peasant war in England, as they had done in Germany. Reformation produces revolution. This is the favourite text of the followers of the Pope. Violent hands must be laid upon heretics. The charge of the priests, yes, non plui Deus duc ad Christianos, which translates as God sends no rain, lead us against the Christians, the cry ascribed by Augustine to the pagans of the first ages. The charge of the priests was absurd, but the people are blind whenever the gospel is concerned, and occasionally the governors are blind also. Serious reasoning was not necessary to confute this invention. Here, by the way, I will tell you a merry toy, said Latimer one day in the pulpit. Master More was once sent in commission into Kent to help to try out, if it might be, what was the cause of Goodwin Sands and the shelf that stopped up Sandwich Haven. He called the country afore him, such as were thought to be men of experience, and among others came in an old man with a white head, and one that was thought to be a little less than 100 years old. So Master More called the old aged man unto him and said, Father, tell me, if you can, what is the cause of this great arising of sands and shells hereabout that stop up Sandwich Haven? Forsooth, sir, quoth he, I am an old man, for I am well nigh 100, and I think that Tenterden's steeple is the cause of the Goodwin Sands. For I am an old man, sir, and I may remember the building of Tenterden's steeple, and before that steeple was in building there was no manner of flats or sands. After relating this anecdote, Latimer slyly added, Even so, to my purpose is preaching of God's word the cause of rebellion, as Tenterden's steeple was the cause of Sandwich Haven, is decayed. There was no persecution for the presence, as there were other things to be done. Wolsey, still smarting at his failure to reach the pontifical throne, could only think of how he might repay Charles and obstruct his ambitions. But during this time, Tyndale also was pursuing his aim, and the year 1525, memorable for the Battle of Pavia, was destined to be no less so in the British Isles, for a still more important victory. The next chapter is about Tyndale and his work for the Bible translation.